The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Welcome to Discover Extra Edition. Stories from Discover, the magazine of science, that we didn't have time for in our regular monthly podcast. I'm your host, Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Episode number 9 of Discover Extra Edition contains 6 stories covering planetary rings, pellagra, parasites, tumors, degrees of separation, and a disease called TTP. Rings of the Giant Planets. Jupiter's 4 faint and dusty rings probably formed more recently and by a different mechanism than Saturn's, but its moons still play a vital role. Amalthea and Thebe are the likely sources of the material in Jupiter's outer 2 gossamer rings. Thebe orbits within the outer gossamer ring, while Amalthea lies near the outer edge of the inner gossamer ring. Metis and Adrastea, 2 other small moons, orbit near the outer edge of Jupiter's main ring, and are the sources of the dust grains making up the main and innermost halo rings. Some forces work against the rings, keeping them relatively thin. Electromagnetic forces, a phenomenon called plasma drag, and even pressure from sunlight, called the Poynting-Robertson effect, continually remove the micron-sized particles from the rings. But particles sputtered off the moons by meteoroid impacts create dust and continually replenish the rings. The 13 known rings of Uranus are unlike those of Jupiter or Saturn. All but the innermost and 2 outermost of the rings are quite narrow, ranging from just 0.6 to 59.6 miles, 1 to 96 kilometers wide. Their particles are larger than those in Jupiter's rings, but there's little dust. Instead, they're largely made up of ice with organic chemicals mixed in to give the dark appearances, unique among the outer solar system's rings. But there are similarities. Like Jupiter's and Saturn's rings, Uranus's rings are intimately associated with moons and moonlets. Primordial moons the size of Puck, 100 miles in diameter, or larger, would have had a good chance of surviving for several billion years. But not all would escape a devastating fate. Computer simulations show that the 11 inner moons of Uranus are likely the remains of original larger moons broken up by cometary impacts. What's more, the current rate of meteoroid impacts among moons and other icy bodies at Uranus's distance is enough to create all the observed rings and dust bands circling that planet. Because the rings appear to be young, probably not more than 600 million years old, the material in the rings must be continually renewed. Particles blasted off the tiny moons and still unseen moonlets by collisions and meteoroid strikes continually add material to the rings, while the dust continues to dissipate. Neptune's 5 rings and various dust bands are probably even younger than those of Uranus, and the same processes are likely responsible for them and the moons that orbit in or near them. Naiad and Thalassa orbit in the gap between the innermost Gal and Lavuria rings, and Despina orbits just inside the Lavuria ring. Galatea lies slightly inside the outermost Adams ring. These tiny moons are likely rubble pile objects, agglomerations of fragments from earlier Neptunian moons, weakly held together by gravity. The ring particles are material continuously blasted off the moons by meteoroid impacts. Unlike the Uranian rings, the rings of Neptune are quite dusty, thanks to the destruction of a satellite. At least 20% of the material is the size of smoke particles, and in some of the rings, that rises to 70%. A deadly diet. A disease that devastated the American South a century ago lives on. One day in April 2014, Matilda Tissier noticed her hamsters were acting a little odd. The Chrysitis chrysitis in her lab at the University of Strasbourg in France, once happily subsisting on a corn-based diet, were now banging their feeder against the cage, their tongues swollen and black, and had begun to eat their pups alive. As Tissier reported in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B in January of 2017, she suddenly had cannibal hamsters on her hands. "I was shocked," says Tissier, a conservation biologist. "I thought I did something wrong." Searching for an explanation, Tissier teased out a thread that wove through America's past. Some of the symptoms she saw in both the mothers and surviving pups resembled those of a debilitating disease called pellagra. The illness affected more than 3 million people and killed more than 100,000 in the United States, primarily in the South, between 1900 and 1940. The quest to understand and cure the outbreak combined research, social politics, and economic forces. And as Tissier saw firsthand, it's a history we do well to remember. In the early 1900s, cases of a mysterious malady started appearing every summer in the South. At first, patients felt melancholy and weak. Some then developed swollen tongues and drooled excessively. As the disease advanced, people displayed a symmetrical photosensitive rash across their limbs, neck, and face. Some patients' symptoms disappeared a few months later, only to recur the following year. For others, the disease progressed through the four D's: dermatitis, diarrhea, dementia, and death. In 1907, physicians at two southern mental institutions began to suspect their patients' symptoms were the result of pellagra, Italian for rough or dry skin. The disease was first identified in 1735 by the Spanish physician Gaspar Casal, who called it mal de la rosa, disease of the red rash. In the intervening centuries, pellagra was particularly widespread and well documented in northern Italy, with cases reported as far afield as South Africa and Egypt. The U.S. historically had seen few cases. Clearly something had changed. But what? One of the first doctors who made the connection to pellagra was James Babcock of the South Carolina State Hospital for the Insane. In 1908, he traveled to Italy and confirmed that he and his colleagues were right about the disease's diagnosis. He went on to organize the first U.S. conferences on pellagra, where two competing theories on the disease's cause went head to head. One theory held that pellagra was an infectious disease carried by Simulian flies. "This was the golden era of the germ theory," says University of South Carolina internal medicine and infectious disease specialist Charles Bryan, author of Asylum Doctor James Woods Babcock and the Red Plague of Pellagra. Yellow fever, malaria, and Rocky Mountain spotted fever all had been proven in recent years to have an insect vector. Why not pellagra? The other leading theory, originating back with Casal himself, suggested that corn, of all things, was to blame. Some proponents regarded only spoiled corn as the culprit. Others, including Casal, focused on the corn-based diet common among impoverished victims and advocated treating pellagrans, those suffering the disease, with a more varied diet. The U.S. Public Health and Marine Hospital Service, soon to be known as the Public Health Service, PHS, a precursor to the National Institutes of Health, began studying pellagra in 1909. But as the illness spread, South Carolina alone reported 30,000 cases by 1912, Surgeon General Rupert Blue felt increasing pressure to escalate PHS efforts. In 1914, he assigned the PHS pellagra studies to Joseph Goldberger. A Jewish doctor from New York who'd emigrated from Hungary might seem an odd pick to lead a southern campaign, but it did make sense. In many ways, Goldberger was the perfect choice, says American university historian Alan Kraut, author of Goldberger's War, The Life and Work of a Public Health Crusader. He had experience as an epidemic fighter on malaria, typhoid, and dengue fever, and on yellow fever in the South. He was married to a Southern woman, and he had lots of lab experience. Right away, Goldberger saw a flaw in the fly infection theory. Institutions with pellagra cases consistently reported that staff members, presumably vulnerable to the same flies, weren't diagnosed with the disease. The recent identification of diseases caused by dietary deficiencies further convinced Goldberger that a corn-based diet could be pellagra's cause. The grain had only recently become a popular foodstuff. As King cotton and textile mills came to dominate the South's post-Civil War economy, many families converted all their farmland to cotton. They stopped planting vegetables and keeping livestock. As a result, many poor Southerners now ate almost exclusively what was called the three M's: low-quality meat, molasses, and meal, industrial refined cornmeal. The same cheap gruel often served at orphanages and asylums. Pellagra was most widespread among populations subsisting on the three M's. To test his diet theory, Goldberger supplied what he called a diet such as that enjoyed by well-to-do people, meat, milk, and vegetables, to two Mississippi orphanages and an asylum. Pellagra rates there plummeted. His next quest? To induce pellagra in healthy subjects. In 1915, with pardons in hand from Mississippi's progressive governor, Goldberger recruited 12 healthy volunteers at the Rankin State Prison Farm to eat the 3M's diet. Within the six-month trial period, six volunteers exhibited the telltale dermatitis. Goldberger was convinced he had proven the link between the Southern poverty diet and pellagra. To bolster his case against the germ theorists, in 1916 Goldberger conducted what he called filth parties. He tried to infect himself, his wife, and other volunteers with pellagra by injecting and ingesting the skin scales, urine, feces, blood, and saliva from pellagra patients. No one got pellagra. He also organized extensive epidemiological studies of seven villages that conclusively proved the link between pellagra and poverty. The studies are still used in medical schools today and hailed for their thorough, groundbreaking analysis of where economics, social conditions, and health intersect. Yet pellagra raged on, propelled by plummeting cotton prices in 1920. Goldberger advocated for food aid for the South to mitigate what the PHS called a veritable famine developing in the cotton belt due to poor farmers' diets. Southern politicians and businessmen railed against the recommendation, which they perceived as an attack on their honor. Goldberger didn't understand Southern pride, Kraut says. His mission was to conquer the suffering and solve the medical mystery. He still had a ways to go. Goldberger focused on identifying the missing dietary element, which he called the PP factor, for pellagra preventative. In 1922, he tried to induce black tongue disease, the canine analog of pellagra, in his laboratory dogs by feeding them a diet typical of poor Southerners, plus brewer's yeast, purely to stimulate the dog's appetite. The dogs remained healthy, prompting suspicion. Without the yeast, the dogs developed pellagra. Repeated testing on the dogs, then, on human subjects, confirmed that brewer's yeast, a product the poor could afford, contained the PP factor that cured and prevented pellagra. Goldberger was finally publicly vindicated in 1927. That spring, the Mississippi River flooded, to devastating effect. The potential for a widespread pellagra outbreak surged in flood-ravaged areas of Tennessee, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Goldberger oversaw the Red Cross's distribution of 12,000 pounds of brewer's yeast in those areas. That effort cured most pellagrans within 6 to 10 weeks, prevented untold thousands more cases, and earned Goldberger the recognition that was long overdue, though he wouldn't enjoy it for long. Goldberger died in 1929, the same year that pellagra cases at large started declining. The Red Cross carried on his work. By 1937, it had distributed 500,000 pounds of brewer's yeast, frequently referred to as vitamin G for Goldberger. That year, researchers identified niacin, abundant in brewer's yeast, as the elusive PP factor, and doctors established a standard dosage and therapy. Niacin has since become a dietary staple, now better known for fighting high cholesterol than pellagra. Today, pellagra is mostly related to history lessons and medical reference books. But occasionally, such as during isolated outbreaks in a refugee crisis, the world receives a vivid reminder of how the disease still affects people. And as Tissier saw in her hamsters, it's also a lesson anyone caring for animals should keep in mind. This scourge is not gone, just largely forgotten. Something Within. A 13-year-old West African boy confounds American doctors with health complaints that don't add up. By the time he reached Los Angeles, Landry was scared, dazed, and exhausted. Flying for the first time in his life, the 13-year-old from Cameroon was now some 8,200 miles from all things familiar. Landry, whose parents had recently died in a car crash, came to L.A. to live with his legal guardian. Although Aunt Delphine welcomed him warmly, Landry's first night in America was restless. His left ankle was puffy and warm. He settled into his new environment, attending school and studying English, while speaking French and Cameroonian pidgin at home. He played soccer and watched YouTube videos on his cell phone, but his ankle and lower leg continued to swell on occasion. "In the hospital where I work," Delphine, a certified nursing assistant, told Landry, "elderly people can have blood clots that make their limbs swell. But in someone your age, that doesn't make sense. The next time this funny thing happens, please tell me tout suite, and I'll take you to a clinic." Sure enough, Landry's symptoms returned, and Delphine cajoled a local doctor into ordering an MRI of her nephew's leg. But the swelling was gone by the time the scan was performed. The doctor shrugged. He wasn't convinced that Landry's swelling was real. Plus, the boy's remark about something under his skin sounded downright bizarre. Was Landry suffering from depression? Grief? Culture shock? A week later, Delphine asked the clinic to perform a routine blood test to rule out an elevated white blood cell count, which might suggest an infection. The result was so surprising the lab called back the next day. Although Landry's total white count was fine, his array of cells was not. Instead of the usual distribution, more than 60% were eosinophils, a type of white blood cell that normally lives in tissue rather than blood. Although scientists still don't fully understand how eosinophils help sustain health, in certain diseases they surge, spill into blood, and release toxic proteins. Doctors must consider many diagnoses for people with excess eosinophils. In a small percentage of patients, cancer, leukemia, or a rare inflammatory disease may drive bone marrow to overproduce this type of cell. A far more common cause is an allergy to a pollen, chemical, or drug. But even when suffering an allergic crisis, people normally don't have Landry's elevated level of eosinophils. Another possibility is a parasite, a broad category of infectious agents that are commonly transmitted in the tropics, including in Cameroon. Of all the parasites that trigger a massive outflow of eosinophils, migrating worms, literally worms that travel through blood, tissues, and organs, top the list. Could one of these multicellular creatures and its offspring reside within Landry? And if so, what type? Dr. Katasadeyarat, a local pediatrician treating the teen, reached out to me for advice. "What are we missing?" she asked. "What test should we run next?" She had already excluded several tropical worms, including common gut parasites such as hookworm and roundworm, an intestinal invader known as Strongyloides, and schistoma, a leaf-shaped parasitic flatworm acquired by contact with water fouled by human waste. But what about worms transmitted by an insect bite? Dr. K hadn't mentioned these exotic foes. I suggested she ship Landry's serum to a special lab at the National Institutes of Health. Several weeks later, my suspicion was confirmed. Crawling inside Landry was a worm exclusive to West and Central Africa, Loa Loa. In 1979, I was a rookie doc at the Hospital for Tropical Diseases in London, a crumbling structure straight out of a Dickens novel. Every week I met patients from different parts of the world. One of them was an African woman with unusual complaints. She had originally told her general practitioner that her limbs sometimes swelled, that something was crawling in her skin, and that once or twice a transparent worm had slinked across her eye. Her doctor thought she was suffering from delusions and sent her to a psychiatrist. Months later, I saw her at the London hospital. She had high levels of eosinophils, and her blood contained microscopic larvae of L. loa, a thread-like worm that initially enters humans via the bite of a parasite-laden fly. But not just any fly. The worm is transmitted only by certain species of deer flies. These cagey insects know how to find a meal. After breeding in mud along shaded streams, they fly high above the ground in search of warm-blooded animals. Specific activities attract them. For example, animal motion, breath exhalations, and even rising puffs of wood smoke. Target found, they dive bomb and bite their quarry in order to siphon a small amount of blood. Some bites can transmit an early stage of loa. Months later, the larvae introduced by bites become mature worms that freely roam beneath their host's skin, sometimes traveling up to 1 centimeter per minute and causing brief periods of swelling. Adult worms have also been known to cross the eyeball during their travels through the body. After mating, females give birth to new waves of offspring that live in the blood. Today, the parasite remains a health problem, inhabiting roughly 12 million people, mostly living in Africa's backcountry. Once Dr. K learned that Landry's blood tested positive for loa, she called the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to obtain diethyl carbamazine, or DEC. The medicine is used to treat specific parasitic infections and can kill loa in its adult and larval stages. Landry was admitted to a hospital to begin treatment using DEC, low-dose steroids, and allergy medications. After 2 days of treatment, I visited him and his indefatigable aunt on the ward. The medicines appeared to be working. According to the morning's lab work, Landry's eosinophil count had already gone down. "Yes, thank you, I am feeling fine," he said in a musical lilt, as Delphine beamed. She smoothed her rumpled clothes after spending the night on a bed in the room. "And how is school and life in L.A.?" I continued. "I'm sure you also miss home." "He's doing very well in English," Delphine interjected as the teen nodded. He then described several happy summers spent in his grandparents' Cameroonian village by a river thick with flies. For the rest of the day, I periodically thought of Landry. I imagined all that he had left behind in his former country, and all that now lay ahead for him in America. Tumors in real time. A researcher works to destroy cancers before they take shape. In his 40-plus years as a developmental biologist at the University of Iowa, David Saul studied HIV, yeast infections, and white blood cells. But after his wife died from a brain tumor 8 years ago, Saul set his sights on cancer. Using a 3D software system his lab previously designed to follow cell movement, Saul began tracking human tumor cells, including from breast, skin, and brain cancers, photographing them from multiple angles every 10 minutes for up to 3 months. By studying the 3D images chronologically, Saul became the first person to witness tumors forming in real time. It turns out that several cancers form tumors in a similar way, and he believes that one drug, yet to be discovered, could inhibit tumor formation in all cancers. As director of the university's Developmental Studies Hybridoma Bank, which houses the world's largest academic collection of biological agents with cancer-fighting potential, he has access to thousands of potential weapons. A hybridoma is the hybrid of a normal cell fused with a cancer cell, and each specific hybridoma produces a unique antibody that could treat different diseases. Sol has tested about 300 cancer antibodies so far, and two have successfully stopped the formation of human tumors in cells suspended in transparent gel. Sol spoke with Discover about tumor formation and the possibility of a cancer cure. Question: why use your lab's technology to study cancer in this way? Answer: we wanted to do something unique. We knew we had this beautiful software that could be converted into studying how a model tumor can actually form. Question: what was it like seeing tumors form in real time? Answer: we were blown away. We saw these specialized cells come out of the tumor, make cables, contract and bring previously existing surrounding smaller tumors into the bigger tumor. And they keep doing it as far as they could reach, until all of the little pillars are just one tumor. They seem to know what they're doing. In other words, it's not some random thing making the initial tumor. It's figured out. Question: you've described your connection to the hybridoma bank as serendipity. Why? Answer: we were sitting there and we just said, oh my God, we're studying cancer and we have these two things. Why don't we join together the laboratory that does the three-dimensional reconstruction and the laboratory that does antibodies? It's just total serendipity that I had ended up running the hybridoma bank and also had the software to do this stuff. Question: has your research changed your opinion about whether it's possible to cure cancer? Answer: I not only believe that you can cure cancer, but I believe in the idea of commonality, curing all cancers the same way. We're looking for a magic bullet. And when you say magic bullet, every cancer guy cringes because they think you're full of shit. But I've never seen such commonality before for such behavior that has to do with cancer. Question: how might this be used in humans one day? Answer: it could be used to stop metastasis, the spread of cancer. You could start injecting this stuff to prevent any new tumors from forming while you're undergoing radiation and chemo. This does not stop the original cancer from happening. If we found an original tumor, or a tumor that is just starting, we'll stop them from growing, while other reliable therapies would actually kill cancer cells. Degrees of separation from water on Mars to infertility. 50 miles. About the height to which Martian dust storms can fling the planet's water. Researchers examined over a decade's worth of data and realized the storms ferried water vapor and ice away from the surface and up into the atmosphere. There, the sun's ultraviolet rays broke down the vapor and ice into oxygen and hydrogen. The hydrogen then escaped the atmosphere, further dehydrating the red planet. 807,000. The number of people in one study, based in Denmark, looked at to determine that there's an association between developing dementia and lithium levels in drinking water. Citizens who ingested higher levels of lithium, about 0.015 milligram per liter, were less likely to develop dementia than those whose drinking water had lower levels of the metal. $3 million. Estimated worth of all the gold and silver floating around in Switzerland's wastewater. A recent assessment of the trace elements that wind up in the country's water treatment plants says that in some areas, concentrations of gold are comparable to those in profitable mining ores. But overall, it's not worth it to extract the precious metals from the sewage. 4 million tons. The maximum yearly amount of plastic that makes its way into the oceans from rivers, according to a recent paper. The same study claims that just 10 rivers in the world are responsible for ferrying at least 88% of the plastic pollution present in the seas. 99%. Sea turtles from the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef that were born female in 2014 and 2015. A new study attributes this disproportion to climate change. Female turtles tend to hatch in warmer temperatures, while males are more likely to emerge from cooler conditions. 80%. The proportion of women, in a study of 211, who had traces of a particular organophosphate flame retardant in their urine while undergoing in vitro fertilization, IVF. This kind of chemical is found in common household items, such as upholstered furniture. Experts found that women who had traces of the compounds in their systems were less likely to have a successful IVF outcome. By its cover, a 20-something father falls apart, but for unexpected reasons. Spit flew from Sam's mouth as he fought the handcuffs chaining him to the gurney. He swatted away a thermometer and strained against the blood pressure cuff. Eventually, a nurse calmed him enough to measure his vital signs. His blood pressure, temperature, and heart rate were skyrocketing. The nurse called me and a resident physician to his bedside. The 26-year-old was mumbling and shaking. His eyes darted, and his body jerked at every loud noise in the busy ER hallway. "What happened? Why the police escort?" I asked, glancing at the officer nearby. "He was found like this at home," the nurse said. "Drugs, I think. He's been here before for meth. Sad situation." She moved on to the next patient. The officer filled us in on the details. A neighbor had heard a baby screaming in Sam's apartment for hours. After knocking with no answer, she called the police, who banged down the door. They found Sam lying on the floor, shirtless and incoherent, his daughter crying in a soiled diaper beside him. Sam's medical chart revealed several past visits for methamphetamine intoxication, just as the nurse had said, and no mention of other medical problems. Sam was unable to add further details. He was babbling and his speech was slurred. Blood trickled from a scalp wound on the back of his neck, the only injury we could find. Further tests revealed nothing alarming, though his urine had some blood. "Let's sew up his head laceration, then let him come down from his high while we wait for the urine toxicology results," the resident said. Sam's cut was only a few inches long and not deep, an easy repair, but it kept bleeding as I sewed, gumming up my sutures. I had to stop after each stitch to clean away fresh blood. I recalled the trace blood in Sam's urine. Meth shouldn't make you bleed, I thought. In the middle of this busy afternoon, I took a break to read Sam's drug screen results. I read them three times, thinking there was an error. There were no signs of meth or any other drugs in his body. Could he have used something like bath salts or synthetic marijuana that a basic screen could miss? Did he have a rare type of brain infection not found in our primary spinal fluid testing? Or was he afflicted by something else entirely? I returned to his bedside. Sam was clutching his bedsheet, looking confused and feverish. The whites of his eyes had a golden tinge I hadn't noticed before. A crimson halo stained his pillow. His cut was still bleeding. I looked down at the urine collecting in his catheter. It was the color of Dr. Pepper. These findings pointed in one direction. The answer was in his blood. A few simple tests confirmed my suspicion. His level of platelets, the cells that clot the blood, was extremely low. Under a microscope, I saw that his red blood cells were crescent-shaped and shredded rather than healthy, plump discs. His level of bilirubin, the waste left when red blood cells are damaged, was too high. His urine contained more blood, and his kidney function was worsening. At the nurse's station, I rummaged through the overstuffed bookshelf to find the blood disorders textbook, its binding worn and cover faded. His symptoms matched a dangerous blood condition. Sam had an unusual disease with a tongue-twisting name: thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, or TTP. In TTP, an enzyme that's essential to clotting blood malfunctions, causing platelets to stick together in large clumps. Like boulders on a road, the clumps block blood from traveling through the veins. Red blood cells fail to deliver oxygen because they break, trying to get through. Without oxygen, organs start to malfunction. Sam's suffocating brain caused his hallucinations and confusion. Littered with destroyed red blood cells, his body became overwhelmed with bilirubin, staining the whites of his eyes yellow. His skin blossomed with purpura, a rash resulting from clots blocking and bursting capillaries. With most of his platelets preoccupied in dysfunctional clumps, his bleeding from his head wouldn't stop. Sam's blood, ironically, was clotting too much and therefore unable to clot when actually needed. He needed treatment fast. Without it, he could have a seizure or stroke and die. We watched as Sam's blood flowed out of his body and into the hulking machine next to his bed, whirring and spinning as it replaced his plasma with that of a donor. This exchange clears the blood of autoantibodies, the rogue elements that attack an essential clotting enzyme leading to TTP. Often, TTP is related to another condition, lupus, pregnancy, or HIV infection, or a medication such as chemotherapy or quinine. It's occasionally due to a genetic flaw that leaves the clotting enzyme defective. In about half of all cases, it is an autoimmune condition. Instead of performing its usual role, fighting bacteria or viruses, the immune system attacks the body's own clotting system. This is what happened to Sam. Between plasma exchange treatments, Sam passed his time lifting small hand weights and doing push-ups. "Gotta keep my strength up," he said most mornings when we checked in on him. He impressed us with his wit. Photos of his daughter filled his bedside table. After a few days of treatment, Sam was discharged from the hospital. But his plight wasn't over. Months later, Sam was back in the emergency room, feeling foggy, hot, fatigued, and blooming with bruises. No one thought he was high this time. His TTP had returned despite the plasma exchanges. Doctors gave him steroids to calm his immune system and a drug called rituximab to halt production of his destructive autoantibodies. That seemed to do the trick. But a few months later, while shaving at home, Sam noticed in the bathroom mirror that his eyes were yellow and that a small shaving cut on his chin wouldn't stop bleeding. He returned to the ER, where the second return of his TTP was confirmed. The only hope left was to remove his spleen. Normally, the spleen sits in the abdomen, where it cleans and stores blood cells. In autoimmune TTP, the spleen harbors the cells that produce autoantibodies. Without a spleen, Sam's body might stop making these attackers, finally allowing his enzymes and platelets to work undisturbed. Sam's surgery was a success. His TTP never returned. His blood kept flowing smoothly, only clotting when needed to repair life's cuts and scratches. At times, physicians find what we expect to find, causing us to be lulled by our assumptions. We assumed Sam's symptoms were related to meth because of his past. His case reminded me to always keep an open mind when making a diagnosis, even in the face of persuasive circumstantial evidence. That wraps up this episode of Discover Extra Edition. I hope you've enjoyed it and will tune in to another podcast soon. Until then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.